traveling hundreds of miles across Northeast Florida in a unique riverboat tour. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. And also make sure now that you watch the show with video on demand at our partner TVJax.com. Just ahead, St. John's River keeper Lisa Reinemann is back on land and taking your calls about the Save the St. John's tour. We'll tell you about it. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's National Donate Life Month, and the Katie Ride for Life is such a big part of that every April on the First Coast. Details, plus Cole Pepper on the college basketball championships, all going down tonight. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, it was an incredible journey as advocates for the St. John's River traveled by water 310 miles from the headwaters at Fort Drum to the river's mouth at Mayport. The Save the St. John's River tour just wrapped up over the weekend, bringing together people all united against the degradation of this vital natural resource here on the First Coast. Lisa Reinemann, the St. John's River Keeper, is here now with a look back at this major trip and what comes next. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And what are your questions for River Keeper Lisa Reinemann about the Save the St. John's tour? Give us a call now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. You just got done with this, and what a journey it was. People were following along on your website, SaveTheSt.John's.org. 13 days on the river, yeah?
Oh, my gosh. It was fantastic, Melissa. The people we met, the places we saw, the food that we ate at the fish camps along the way, it was absolutely incredible.
And you started all the way down in Vero Beach area, made your way all the way up to Mayport, with the idea of raising awareness about this river. Can you tell us how this all came together?
Well, we realize in the work that we do to protect and defend and restore the St. John's, we have to take a holistic approach. We spend a lot of time in Orlando and all the counties along the St. John's working with elected officials and water planners to encourage them to respect and value the St. John's. And we really realize we could do that better and more effectively if we're working with folks along the entire river who care as much about protecting the St. John's, her tributaries, and her springs as we do.
We'll go to your calls for Lisa Reinemann about the Save the St. John's tour in just a moment at 549-2937. It's the longest river in Florida, 310 miles long, and the watershed drains nearly 16% of the state. And as your website points out, it is home to almost 5 million people. But of course, you, the St. John's River Keeper, are leading the charge to raise awareness and reverse decades of pollution and degradation. Can you explain a little bit about the threats to the river?
Most definitely. And unfortunately, you know, we have routinely treated our river like a sewer. It's a place you can dump things. It goes out to the ocean, out of sight, out of mind. But it's not that simple. Our river is a very lazy river. And when bad things go in, they stick around. It's tidally influenced. So they oscillate around in the system. And there's areas of impact throughout the tributaries, the springs that are also suffering from pollution. At the same time, we're damaging our wetlands and our grasses. Those are the kidneys of our river. So we're putting more pollution in than the river can handle. And we're damaging our wetlands with things like water withdrawals and dredging over time. That's it's creating a problem for our river and how she handles dealing with the pollution we put in.
In a moment, I can't wait to hear about the comprehensive restoration plan you're working to create and engage everybody on for the St. John's River. But you mentioned dredging. Of course, Jacksport has plans to dredge the St. John's River in our area down to a depth of 47 feet to accommodate larger ships expected to come to our port via the Panama Canal, a widened Panama Canal. You filed a lawsuit on Friday to stop that dredging. Can you tell us why?
Most definitely. The Army Corps plan and the permit that was issued by the state does not fortify and protect the St. John's River. We've been working for more than 4 years to have a balanced approach to make sure that our tributaries in the St. John's are protected. And unfortunately, this permit fails that. And it's not just about the river. This will do damage to our fisheries, which will have an economic impact on our waterways. There's erosion, sedimentation. And so we have one chance to get it right, and this permit does not do it.
What would you say to advocates of the dredging who believe that this would be an absolute business bonanza for Northeast Florida? your critics say that the environmental concerns are overblown.
Yes, the economic risks are great. And so those that are promoting it as an economic boom, I'd ask them to look very closely at the facts. I'd ask them to look very closely at our economic reports that we have on our website that talk about not our studies, but studies done by others that show that it does put our community at great risk. The only economist that says that it's a good thing for Jacksonville is the one Jacksport hired. And so I'd ask them to look very carefully at that, especially those decision makers who are wanting to spend more than $700 million of taxpayer money and what that risk truly is.
In the meantime, now that you've wrapped up this 13-day tour of the river, you want to put together a comprehensive restoration plan for the entire length of the river and its watershed. What would that plan entail?
Well, we worked with scientists along the way. We have to look at the restoration of our springs. We have to look at restoration of our tributaries. There are tributaries along the way, starting pretty much with the Econ Waikachi south of Orlando, that are already too polluted with nutrient pollution. But there are ways that we can capture the work that has been done by scientists and learn from past failures and problems like we see with the horrible fish kill in the Indian River Lagoon. Learn from those mistakes so we truly will protect and save the St. Johns.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your questions and comments about the Save the St. Johns tour, a 13-day tour of the St. Johns River, all 300-plus miles of it? St. Johns River Keeper Lisa Reinemann was the captain of this whole journey. She is taking your calls right now at 549-2937. John in St. Augustine is with us. Hi, John. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I was wondering if anybody considers that spring that's offshore on Crescent Beach. If I remember right, it was the second largest spring in Florida, and the water was tested years ago. Claude Kirk was going to go there right away on the railroad and put it in South Florida, but I think they put the glass cable there instead. And it was 6 million years old, the water, they said, that came out of there. But that, I'm sure it has a lot of minerals, but I was wondering if, and I saw a picture of it underwater, it looked like a funnel. You know, it didn't look like an ecosystem growing there much. And that's a huge source of water. I just wonder if it's considered practical to put it by pipeline to Central Florida and reverse osmosis some degree, but maybe less than if it was the salt water.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, John.
And John, yes, people have looked at that. Water planners have looked at that. Unfortunately, that spring is suffering the same fate of many of our springs throughout Florida with a pretty severe reduction of flow. But the main thing that has been, it's cost prohibitive. What the water planners are looking to, the cheapest source of water. And so that's siphoning more than 160 million gallons a day from the St. Johns, which unfortunately is not sustainable. Our rivers already suffered from a reduction of flow due to overpumping our aquifer. And so it's like robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's not a sustainable choice for long term.
549-2937. We lost a call from Palatka, but we typically get calls from across the listening area for the Riverkeeper. We'll go back to the phones in just a moment at 549-2937. Here's a tweet for you. A year ago, we were talking about dredging. The Army Corps was greatly underestimating costs for harbor projects. What is the status?
Well, the Army Corps has a really bad track record of getting the cost right, as well as the environmental impacts. You can look at the Miami dredge to see an example of that. And right now, they are still focusing on a cost of nearly $800 million. The funding is not in place. However, they are aggressively moving forward. Right now, they do have funding for the permit, so the permit is going through the process. We had a very short window to challenge that permit. It's good for 10 years, so it is our responsibility to make sure that the permit's protected by the river. And even though the money's not in place, we have to make sure that the permit does not move forward as is.
You're also planning a separate federal challenge to dredging the St. Johns River. And there was a recent skirmish in Tallahassee where lawmakers passed an industry-backed overhaul to the state's water policy. That transfers more of DEP's authority, the Department of Environmental Protection, to the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Governor Rick Scott has cut staff and funding at the DEP and the state's water management districts. This seems to be a statewide battle. It goes beyond the St. Johns River between advocates for the waterways and advocates for agriculture and business.
Yes, and if you look at the Indian River Lagoon fish kill, it's an example of why that approach will not work. There are too many band-aid short-term approaches that are made to this nutrient pollution, which is causing the brown algae, which is killing hundreds of fish, thousands of fish in that area. That could have been prevented, but it's not going to be prevented if you're focusing on, you know, band-aid fixes that allow agriculture, urban runoff, stormwater to not do their part. We have to proactively keep the pollution out because it's much more costly to undo the damage once it's done.
Lots of calls now for Riverkeeper Lisa Reinemann, 549-2937, to call in with your questions and comments. Jennifer is in San Marco. Hi, Jennifer. Good morning. Jennifer, you're on the air. All right, Jennifer, give us a call back, 549-2937. Mincy in Jacksonville. Hi, Mincy. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing just fine. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
Yeah, I often say, I often have this saying, I like to have smarter people around me. I definitely don't know it all. I have some background and interest in the economic impact that dredging could do for our city as a participant as a longshoreman in that industry. But I also, I'm a lover of our environment. And so my question basically is, I know the lawsuit was filed, but do you think that we could reach a common ground? You know, I often hear both sides of the stories, and I'm kind of like the solutions guy. What would be the ideal situation, or could there be one, that dredging could exist, that economic impact could happen, and maybe we could have a win-win situation? I'd like to host it, if you would, just share, in a dream world, what would be the ideal situation?
Yeah, sure.
And how long
okay.
would it take?
Yeah, great question. What's a win-win?
Well, and Mincy, we have the same opinion. We're solution-based, and we've worked for years with the Army Corps in Jacksonville, City of Jacksonville, and continue to do so because we do believe there was a balanced approach available. Unfortunately, we failed to get there. There are restoration plans, including the Ocklawaha and many other tributaries in the lower basin of the St. Johns that could truly offset the damage that's anticipated and would absorb some of the impact so it would not impact our fisheries and other jobs that depend on a healthy St. John's.
But you don't think that we're going to be able to get to that win-win?
We're going to continue to work towards it. And you know, we've tried to negotiate. We've entered in some unusual alliances with the Chamber of Commerce and Jacksport. And unfortunately, now we're at a legal level of conversation.
Jennifer in San Marco is back with us. Jennifer, you're on the air. Thanks for calling back. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. First of all, Lisa, thank you so much. It is amazing, wonderful news to hear that you all have gone forward with filing a lawsuit and bringing all of these things under closer examination. I think a couple of things that are good to point out regarding the economic impact primarily. I've gleaned through the report that was produced by Jacksport as to how many jobs and how much money was going to be produced. But from what I can tell, we're really talking about heavier boats, boats with more cargo, not necessarily bigger boats. And that's really going to directly benefit a small handful of companies, logistics, shipping, trains, rail, the people who own these docks and own these shipping locations that are on the port. And I think the impact for the local folks is very minimal compared to the tremendous cost that is going to be hard to correct at a later date.
Okay. Thanks, Jennifer.
And Jennifer, you're absolutely correct. The Army Corps, when they do their economic analysis, the only criteria they look at is the reduction of cost for shippers. And so that is not an economic impact or benefit for the local area. That is for offshore, out of, you know, overseas shippers that come to the area. And they look at that. They don't look at how the East Coast ports work with one another. However, there's article and studies at one after the other that show if we deepen all the East Coast ports, we all shoot ourselves in the foot because we put ourselves in an unfortunate competitive situation that does not benefit the local community.
549-2937. Karen in Palatka. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi, this is Karen Chadwick in Palatka. And I was very fortunate to be able to go along with the riverkeeper on several of her excursions in the Putnam County area, and I just really appreciate what she's doing to put this plan together. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you plan to do in the future to come back to the different communities and have some updates.
Yeah, a lot of people came on this tour with you. Thanks for calling, Karen. What was it like for people that rode along?
Well, and thanks, Karen. We so appreciate the time you spent with us out on the water. You know, we captured every single place. We not only for our short videos that you can see at SaveTheSt.John's.org, we're also going to make a documentary, not on the trip, but on the river and the people who thrive along the banks of the St. John's, mm-hmm. as well as go back and work with each community about their concerns, about their piece of this river puzzle, and then figure out how we put these pieces together strategically mm-hmm. and aggressively to protect our waters.
549-2937 as we go to Ricky on the north side. Hi, Ricky. Good morning. Ricky, are you there? I don't know what's going on today. I'm sorry, Ricky. Give us a call back. I accidentally dropped you there. Call us back. Larry is downtown. Larry, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I got a question. What organizations or group of either scientists or experts that have looked at this that had nothing to do with either the port or Mrs. Lineman's position?
Yeah, is there a truly neutral arbiter in all of this? Thanks for that question.
There was the Jacksonville Port Task Force that had people present to them over a course, gosh, I guess it was about 18 months that they met. Mm-hmm. And they did, at the very end of their work, they did say that more mitigation was needed based on presentations we made as well as other scientists in the area. So that was probably the most impartial group, but they did agree based on their research and presenters that came that more mitigation was needed above and beyond the Army Corps plan.
What would that mitigation look like? What would that involve?
Well, you know, The true project that has been studied by federal agencies and actually recommended by the National Marine Fisheries was the Ocklawaha restoration. The impact of restored wetlands, of restored freshwater flow, and the benefit to our fisheries, the Corps said, is too much benefit. It's too great. Which we argue with that. What does that mean? You know, we obviously want to protect our river as much as possible, but there's also other tributaries in the area that could be restored to help this overall balance approach.
And we have Ricky back on the north side. Ricky, good morning. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Yes, I wanted to find out if, one question actually. The question is that do we really think that the people that are doing the studies and so forth, you know, are going to be effective against the establishment that is and against you. The reason I'm asking is there was an article in the Folio Weekly indicating that there was a sediment of the damage that Georgia Pacific was doing by pumping their recycled water back into St. John's, and Georgia Pacific didn't like that study, so they decided to hire a new group to do a different study that would favor them. So my question is, what do you do with people like that that know what the facts are but refuse to accept them? Thank you.
Well, and that's why we work with scientists to review their reports, which we did in that case. We realized that there was a problem, and so we put together a team to build up a scientific foundation to hold over them to say, this is a problem, and you have a responsibility to get to the bottom of it, and then we have to continuously beat a steady drum until they will, number one, listen, come to the table, and do something about it. Good news is, based on that approach, Georgia Pacific has agreed to do more monitoring. However, now we think their scope of work falls short, so we're continuing to work with them to do the right study to understand what's going on. And if they fail to do so, we will do our own monitoring to hold them accountable.
And you're trying basically to hold not only business accountable, but government. There are times when you've been at odds with government entities in a state where the legislature is dominated by business interests.
Most definitely. You know, protecting our natural resources, our waters, you know, that's our competitive advantage as a state. It should be a bipartisan thing because it makes Florida great. But unfortunately, there's been major cuts to our water management, major cuts in monitoring. We have less data on our river now than we used to. And so we are continuously butting heads, if you will, with the regulatory agencies. In the case of Georgia Pacific, we believe that the Department of Environmental Protection has a responsibility to understand what's going on out there. And unfortunately, they failed to hold Georgia Pacific accountable to more monitoring. We're trying to work closely with them to make sure they get that right, as well as the cattle ranch in outside of Silver Springs. We're in the middle of litigation with the Water Management District on that. And we try to show up at every meeting to encourage good decision making based on fact and science. And if we can't get there, then we will litigate.
Let's get in a few more calls for St. John's Riverkeeper Lisa Reinemann. Mark in Jacksonville. Mark in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been vacationing down in Vero Beach for about 30 years, and I think the fish kill there is a result of two things. It's the Army Corps of Engineer putting water into the system, draining off of Lake Okeechobee, and it's the proliferation of septic systems, which the local community has known about for, you know, decades, but refuses to address. It seems to be a lack of coordination, you know, on the local, state, and federal level to sort of, you know, make it all work. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mark.
And Mark, you're right. I mean, you've got the Lake Okeechobee, you have, then up further north where this particular fish kill was, you have a tremendous amount of runoff, failing septic tanks, too much fertilizer's going to the system. And as we speak, the Water Management District is considering reversing that flow back into the St. John's so those nutrients could come into the St. John's, undermining the health and the headwaters, which we have to ensure does not happen.
Dave in Riverside. Dave, hi. How are you? Go ahead.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I want to know, where is the outrage when these fairly well-to-do businessmen come with their hands out from the local taxpayers? And how much money are they expecting us to give when we can't even pay our police and fire pensions? We can't alleviate the failed septic tanks in our own community here. Where's the outrage they want handouts from us?
You know, and that's a great question. Part of the problem with the timing is they do the scientific piece of it, the permitting, before they really start talking about where the money's coming from. But it is all coming. There's nearly $800 million coming from us as taxpayers, and they have not identified where that money's coming from today.
The Save the St. John's tour is wrapped up. You can check it all out at your website, savethestjohns.org. What's next?
Well, what's next is how do we capture this energy? How do we capture this knowledge that we gained from meeting with people all along the river? And how do we stay connected? This river's connected. Everything that happens in the headwaters has an impact on us here in Northeast Florida. We need to stay connected very strategically. So we're getting taking the day off today, but tomorrow we're going to be working on that strategic plan, not only in communications, but action for the St. John's, because together we can make a difference.
St. John's Riverkeeper Lisa Reinemann, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later on the show. Cole Pepper on tonight's big college basketball championship matchup. But up next, how the Katy Ride for Life is spreading the word about organ donation. That's after this.
Want to win a GoPro? This is Michael Boylan asking you to join WJCT's spring fundraiser this week for a chance to win that prize or our grand prize, an Apple Watch. We're giving away one prize each week, and the earlier you give, the more opportunities you'll have to win. So don't wait. Support WJCT today. When we reach our $80,000 goal, we'll end the fundraiser. It's time to give now at WJCT.org.
On the next Diane Reim Show, A new report finds that family members caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's are making even greater financial sacrifices than previously thought, like cutting back on work hours and selling personal belongings. Why Alzheimer's is one of the most costly diseases for families and the nation.
Weekday mornings at 10 on 89.9.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part two. Sponsored in part by AARP, Real Possibilities.
Welcome back. Well, April marks National Donate Life Month, a time to raise awareness about the vital importance of organ donation. Now, the Katie Ride for Life coming up in mid-April in this area is such a big part of this effort here on the First Coast. And the story of the late Katie Caples is the reason why. We're going to share it right now as we welcome Jennifer Cook, Executive Director of the Katie Caples Foundation. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Also with us, Dr. Martin May. He's Medical Director of the Kidney Transplant Program at Jacksonville's own Mayo Clinic. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Savannah Mullis. She's a Mayo Clinic employee who donated one of her kidneys to her husband, Cameron. Good to see you.
Good morning.
All right, let's begin with you, Jennifer. In a moment, we'll talk about the transplant program in our area. But first, for people who might have heard the name Katie Caples, let's explain who she was and why her life has had such a big impact.
Sure. Katie Caples was a young lady who was raised in Amelia Island. She was in a tragic car accident in 1998 and died as a result of those injuries sustained. But when she got her driver's license, she made the decision to register as an organ donor. And the silver lining in this tragedy is that she saved five lives through donation and transplant. Mm-hmm. Her parents were so inspired by Katie's decision that she actually made on her own that they decided to form this nonprofit organization whose commitment is to increase the number of registered organ donors. And we do that through educational and awareness raising campaigns. So we go out into high school classrooms and we help young people understand what it means to register as an organ donor. So when they make that decision, they're going to get their driver's license. 97% of organ donation designation happens at the DMV. Mm-hmm. So they have all the tools and the proper information to make an informed decision. So we work within the region, and the Katie Ride is our annual fund and awareness raising event. Happens every April during Donate Life Month. This year, April 16th, and we're expecting about 1,000 participants and volunteers to come out on the day up in Amelia Island.
This is a premier bicycle event, and anyone who can ride a bike can be part of this. And
absolutely,
there's also a walk and a run, too.
Yes, yes. And in fact, this year we've added a fun triathlon. So we have five cycling routes, 18, 34, 63, and 103-mile routes.
Oh,
plus,
wow.
Yeah, that's a long
Whoa.
One. It's a long one.
Oh, man.
Yes. And then we also have a six-mile off-road event that goes through Fort Clinch, a beautiful route. 8K walk and fun run, and then the fun triathlon, which is a 300-yard pool swim, an 18-mile ride, and a 5K run.
Oh, so much to do. Dr. May, this is all to support your efforts at Mayo Clinic. Tell us a little bit about the kidney transplant program at Mayo.
Kidney transplant program at Mayo has been there since about 1998, and we average currently 150 transplants uh-huh. each year. One of our focus is to try to increase living donation. And so this Donor Awareness Month, not only do we want people aware that should a tragedy befall, they can help other people through that process, but we also want them to be aware that there may be people they know in their family, at work, at church, that may benefit from kidney transplant, and they can help by performing living donation for that individual.
And Savannah Mullis, you work at Mayo Clinic, and you actually recently donated a kidney to your own husband.
Yes, ma'am, I did.
And why was that needed?
He has IgA nephropathy. He was diagnosed in 2014 and pretty much went downhill rather quickly.
So what is that condition?
It's an autoimmune disease that okay. essentially kills the filtration portion of his kidneys.
Oh, okay. So, how was the whole procedure for you as a couple?
Emotional.
Yeah.
It was life-changing. I mean, when you have somebody that you love and that you care about that's extremely ill, and just knowing that you can help them is just, it's wonderful.
And you seem to have recovered from the surgery just fine. How are you?
Yes. Yeah, everything's great.
And how's his prognosis?
Wonderful. I mean, he's doing really, really well. I mean, we've had a few hiccups along the way, but that's to be expected with any major life-changing event.
Uh-huh. And, of course, you knew about this kidney transplant program because you work at Mayo Clinic.
Exactly. I actually
worked. Pretty convenient.
Yeah, I actually worked in transplant for a number of years. I haven't worked there in about 3 years, but knowing everybody who works there was an increased advantage.
You know, Jennifer, you tend to think about organ donation as something that happens with tragedy, like someone like Katie Caples losing her life. But this is another way people can be part of the National Donate Life movement.
Correct. The living donation. And Dr. May could actually speak better to the details and technicalities of living donation. But it is something that we are working to educate individuals about as well, create the awareness so people understand that it's not just deceased donation, but there is the living donation.
And not just kidneys, although, of course, that's a big part of Mayo's work.
That's correct. There's liver living donation also. And our emphasis is that even if you're not a good match for your potential recipient, there are programs available to try to find a match, literally kidney swap, where you may still mm-hmm. be beneficial to your potential loved one, but you can also help other lives through that one donation process.
So as you mentioned, Jennifer, the Katie Ride is coming up April 16th on Amelia Island. People
yes.
still need to get online and register. And if you haven't become an organ donor, and when people sometimes hesitate to do that, how can they do that if they haven't already done so? I have it actually marked on my driver's license. It's not difficult to do.
No, not at all. Most people, as I said, register at the DMV when you sign up and get your driver's license. You can also go online to donatelife.net. And we have links on our website, katiecaples.org, KATIECAPLES.org, thekatieride.org, where you can register for the event. We also have links to the registry, registerme.org. These are lots of
websites.
Yes.
Lots of ways to do it.
Exactly. We also have a new scan technology that allows volunteers from these various organizations and associations to register people on the spot through the aperture in a smartphone, and it uploads the information straight into the registry. So technology is helping us out a lot with this.
It's the 12th annual Katie Ride for Life coming up on April 16th. Going to be a glorious day on Amelia Island. Register now, be part of it, and be part of National Donate Life Month. Thanks so much for being here, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Jennifer Cook, Executive Director of the Katie Caples Foundation, Dr. Martin May with Mayo Clinic, and Savannah Mullis joining us to share their stories. Much more still ahead. We'll be right back.
We're committed to reaching as much of our $80,000 goal as possible without program interruptions. If you rely on this service and feel enriched by it, please help sustain it. Give now at WJCT.org or call us at 904-353-9528. And thanks. And don't forget, the drive ends when we reach our goal.
Hi, this is Marco Werman calling from the World Program in Boston.
Oh, hello, my friend.
Are you ready to talk about pufferfish and
making deadly foods
non-deadly? Take a little pull on it and tell us what you're tasting.
If I breathe, you can actually hear me nosing it, right?
That's a nose. It's the first time, I've got to say, I've heard the trumpet used as a percussion instrument. Join us on The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Amy Robach, news anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, will be this year's afternoon keynote speaker at Girls' Day Out, September 17, 2016, Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Amy is also a breast cancer awareness advocate and author of My Breast Cancer Journey, From Fighter to Thriver. For more information or for tickets, log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout.
Welcome back. Well, more than 200 web developers and tech professionals from all over will come to St. Augustine this week to hear from the leading experts in the tech business. It's all part of the Ancient City Ruby Conference. Micah Cooper, a developer at the Jacksonville Beach-based HashRocket firm, is emceeing this whole event, and he's got a preview for us right now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So this has grown every year. This is coming up at the Casa Monica in St. Augustine later this week. HashRocket hosting the event. What's on the agenda?
We have lots of things going on this week. First off, the first day, we're going to have three workshops, all geared towards different levels. A beginner workshop, a more advanced workshop, and then an even more advanced workshop after that. Then the next 2 days, we go through a range of talks and about different subjects related to our programming community.
And in particular, you're going to be focusing on Ruby on Rails. That's an open source code allowing developers to collaborate on concepts and computer applications. I have no idea what that means. Explain for a layperson like me.
It's a form of software to really kind of help people build web applications very rapidly.
Okay.
And helps you, saves a lot of the work because it does a lot of that work for you.
Who should come to Ancient City Ruby Conference?
Anybody who is interested in programming or building web applications. Even if you're more experienced, we have a lot of talks for all ranges. So if it's something you're just trying to get into, or you're looking for work in the area, or looking for work anywhere, a lot of people come there to hire and just learn about the industry and the software.
It's an excellent networking event, and it's a growing sector in this community. This is a big part of our local business community.
Yes,
you
absolutely.
Say, getting bigger all the time.
Oh, it's growing every year. I've been in this industry in this community for about 5 years now, and every year it gets larger. More people are becoming more involved and really finding like meaningful work from it.
How long have you been? You've been at HashRocket. Tell us a little bit about HashRocket.
HashRocket is a web consultancy. We build web applications using Ruby on Rails. We build iPhone apps, Android apps, for really anyone who wants us to build things for them. We are really interested in building any kind of software for these kind of people.
There will be some nationally known subject matter experts coming.
Yes, absolutely.
Who's going to be speaking?
Paolo Peralto, I believe his name is. He's coming from Italy to speak, and he spoke before, and he's a great speaker, very entertaining, very interesting, talking about things that are related to software.
So he's the big name.
He's one of the big names.
One of the big names. What would you say to people who are intimidated by this whole sector? They want to learn more, they want to get involved, but they feel that the barriers are too high.
It is, and I think a lot of people who feel that way maybe just haven't been into the right community. This community in particular is really welcoming to beginners. I came to this community as a beginner, and I didn't know anything. And once I started to get to know these people, they're very welcoming and very open to help, and they really want you to succeed. And that kind of mindset fosters throughout the entire community.
So you came in not knowing how to build websites, how to write code. You learned as you went along?
Right. I learned from the community. I went to a local meetup called Ruby Jacks, which I'm now the organizer of, actually. When I went, I didn't know anything. I just asked questions, and everybody was very helpful and interested in helping me.
We learned recently that the OneSpark crowdfunding event will still be happening this year, but a much smaller event.
Mm-hmm.
Tech startups, are always looking for capital and support, even though the whole tech incubator community they've suffered through the recession like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about the potential for this here in Northeast Florida over the long term?
I think there's a lot of potential. There's a lot of interest, and there's a lot of tech here. It's just not quite the startup tech, but I think that's growing. As these open source technologies get more popular within this community, we'll find a lot more startups, a lot more people being able to access these new startup ideas and find funding for those sort of things.
So in the meantime, if you want to be part of it, you need to come out to the 4th annual Ancient City Ruby Conference. It's coming up Wednesday through Friday in St. Augustine at the Casa Monica Hotel. Can people just roll up or do they need to register?
It's better if you register. Go to ancientcityruby.com.
ancientcityruby.com. It's going to be quite the event. He is MC Micah Cooper, a developer at the Hash Rocket firm, with the preview for us. Thanks. Have a good time.
Thank you so much.
And in a moment, Culpepper on the national championship. That'll be happening tonight.
PBS from filmmaker Ken Burns.
Jackie Robinson was a superstar, but it wasn't enough.
Baseball was a bridge to the civil rights movement, so he said, I'm going to speak out.
He had a kind of fury in him.
Jackie Robinson took on everything we were afraid to face and changed the entire country.
If you only know the legend, you don't know the man. Jackie Robinson, a Ken Burns film. Starting Monday, April 11th at 9, 8 central, only on PBS.
Artists, would you like your photography, music, paintings, or poetry featured on WJCT? Submit your work to The Square, an online gallery and competition for local artists. Winners get a quality video produced by WJCT about their work. If you submitted during a past round, you can submit again. Share your work now at wjct.org/thesquare. Presented by WJCT and Grassroots Natural Market.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the national champion will be crowned tonight in college basketball.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Here to tell us what's at stake for UNC versus Villanova, we welcome Culpepper. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well, Melissa. Well, what's at stake all around the country are that finally the office pools will be settled and set tonight.
Yes, that's right. Now, how are you faring, by the way?
For entertainment purposes only, I need Villanova to win to win the office pool. But I would never root against or for. Yes, I would. So here's what's at stake tonight. We've got Roy Williams, the head coach at North Carolina, going for his third national championship, and Jay Wright, the head coach of Villanova, going for his first. Villanova hasn't won a national championship since 1985 when they famously upset Georgetown. That was the Patrick Ewing-led Georgetown team that had been so dominant, and Villanova was a huge underdog. Now, Villanova will be an underdog, but not as big an underdog as they were back in 1985. North Carolina, it's interesting to note, was the number one team in the country when the season began, and in a season of turmoil with all kinds of teams ascending to the number one spot, including Villanova at one point. It's interesting that here we get at the end of the year and North Carolina has a chance to win the national championship, begin the year number one, end the year number one, despite everything that happened in between. It's also interesting that right now there's sort of a mix in the North Carolina fan base. There's a small but vocal minority that are upset with head coach Roy Williams, despite the fact that they started number one and have a chance to win the national championship for the third time in his tenure.
Well, I'm sure it'll be quite the excitement tonight. Lots of people glued to the TV. That's tonight. Don't miss it. And meanwhile, the Jacksonville Sharks opening their season over the weekend, and the Suns and Armada are getting ready to open up theirs. It's that time of year.
Yeah, those three seasons basically go at the same time, and so it makes for a very busy time in the what we used to call the off season for football in the sports complex. The Sharks lost 64-39 to the LA Kiss. That was the team launched by Gene Simmons and company. They're on the road a week from Monday. And then the home opener, Say it with me, Melissa, against
the hated Orlando Predators.
There you go. On Monday, April the 18th. Two Monday games on the schedule. Rare for an arena football team. The rest of them are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, but they will start out the season with two or three on Mondays. The Suns begin a five-game homestand against the Birmingham Barons starting Thursday to open up the season. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of changes, of course, with the Suns.
Yes.
New owner Ken Babby,
right,
who we had on the show last year.
Mm-hmm.
I was out there on Thursday checking out the new food offerings.
And?
Professionally speaking, of course, much better. They've really upgraded.
The Culpepper seal of approval.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I particularly like the triple play sausage platter.
Your wife wouldn't like that, though. She doesn't eat meat.
Oh, no, she does.
She will eat meat?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
I thought she didn't. Okay.
Yeah, for a while, but, you know, she's come to her senses. So they also have a number of melts and, you know, Grillman's hot dogs that they've upgraded there and some other things. So I think they're making some steps forward. The other thing you'll notice that's new when you go to the baseball grounds is a tiki hut out beyond the left field foul pole. And I think this is going to be a very, very popular place.
I think you're probably right.
The tiki bar out there during the Florida State game last week, that place was jam-packed. That was the first unveiling of the Tiki Bar, and I think that's going to be a very popular location for folks to sit and watch baseball.
We've got a new owner. He's young. He's full of energy. He's making this the ballpark even more fun.
Yeah, and obviously when you come in and you buy a team, a $24, $25 million expenditure, then you decide you're going to put some more money into the ballpark. You like to see that. It was already a great ballpark, but I think this is going to be a very welcome addition to the baseball grounds. The Armada, on the other hand, opens Sunday at the defending champion New York Cosmos. Then they're home a week from Friday against Miami FC. And that game against the Cosmos, interesting because all last year, for all the success the Armada had in their first year in terms of building a community and playing very well at home, they never won on the road. They very nearly beat the Cosmos up in New York, who wound up becoming the defending champion. But this has been a game that Tony Miola, the new head coach, has been pointing toward all preseason, since his very first meeting with the team. He said, that's the game. We're going to get that monkey off our back, and we're going to be winning away. And so that's what's sort of at stake for the Armada on Sunday. This past Saturday, by the way, a lot of optimism around the Anchors Away party that the team held at St. John's Town
and
Center.
And I'm sure you were in your glory at this affair.
I was. We introduced the team
and did
a little town hall, a lot of Q&A, but a lot of energy and excitement around the start of the season.
Excellent. Very cool. Okay, so the Jaguars are getting closer to the draft. You've been writing about this. You are now the official Jaguars writer at the website about.com.
That's right. And one of the things that I've been looking at is, in the last 10 years, how have teams who have traded up and who have traded back done in the draft? Typically, if you trade up into or within the top 10, you will not get what you want out of it. You'll want, you know, there are too many misses. And if you think about, if you spend a top 10 pick on a player, most would expect that player to reach the Pro Bowl, right? So in the last 10 drafts, that's 100 top 10 draft picks, 41 players have made at least one Pro Bowl. So you're talking about 41% of the time a top 10 pick lives up to expectations or comes close to it. It's not that much of a drop-off for the next 30 picks. If you go from picks 11 to 40, you've got about a 33% chance. So if you could trade back and pick up several picks in that kind of tier, that would be a real benefit for the Jaguars because your chances of hitting go up. Even as, you know, listen, scouting is an art as much as it is a science, and it's just hard to do that. Unless the Jaguars are absolutely certain that they love the guy they're picking at number five, if they get a chance to trade back and pick up multiple picks, the math says, the analytics, the low-scale analytics here, say that they should do that. It's not as doesn't bring as much glory on draft day, but down the line, it winds up being a better play.
More of a payoff.
Yeah.
Well, you, of course, are famed for your barbecue. And let's talk for a minute about a big event coming up where Culpepper will be emceeing and leading. It's the Jacksonville Backyard BBQ Championships. This is coming up April 23rd to benefit Daniel Kids. And people need to come out because if you like barbecue, this is probably the Super Bowl of barbecuing in Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's the eighth year we've done this. We have a new location this year. It's at Tailgaters Parking with the construction going on at the stadium. And somewhere between 40 and 60 teams should be a great event. And we know you will know as you come out. A couple of the judges as well, a couple of these celebrity judges who will be on hand.
Oh, really? Some bold faced names, huh? Yeah, that's always fun.
Yeah, and certified judges as well, and a chance for the public to cast their vote for the People's Choice Award as well.
And I didn't even learn this until I got to know this event through you. You have to be certified to judge these barbecue.
Well, to judge the sanctioned barbecue contest, we have both a pro and a backyard category. Okay. So backyard judges will be a mix of certified and celebrity judges, but the pro teams will be judged by certified judges, which some of which have just taken a weekend course, and some of which
means
have
they ate a lot of barbecue over the weekend,
which is not a bad weekend.
Yeah.
And the other, you know, to the other extreme, where you have some people who have judged, you know, hundreds of barbecue contests and been doing it for 50 years.
You can get your tickets now at danielkids.org. That's coming up Saturday, April 23rd at the ballpark, or I should say at the football stadium. And last
Tailgaters parking this year.
Oh, excuse me. Tailgaters parking.
Yeah,
pardon me.
Just east of the stadium there on Talleyrand.
And last but not least, a big congratulations to the Rebalt Lady Trojans basketball team, the pride of Jacksonville, as they were crowned champions of the 2016 Dick's Sporting Goods High School Basketball Championship. This all went down Saturday morning in New York at Madison Square Garden. The Lady Trojans beating Riverdale Maryland Baptist 75-49. Really exciting.
Well, and this is, in essence, a national championship. It's very hard to do a national tournament, of course, in high school sports. But Rebalt has been... The Rebalt women's basketball, girls basketball, has been as dominant a team as any team in Jacksonville in any sport. And so hats off to the squad for going up to New York and having that moment at Madison Square Garden.
Absolutely. And follow Cole Pepper for all your sports news and notes at Cole Pepper. Good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Michelle Corum running the board this morning. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchik. Never miss a show. Make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And you can now watch the show with our video on demand partners, TVJax.com and MetroJacksonville.com. Next on Diane Rehm, a new report finds family members caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's are making even greater financial sacrifices than previously thought. A panel of guests looks at why Alzheimer's is one of the most costly diseases for families and the nation. That conversation's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.